is Heritage Unbounded, a podcast series of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Join us as we keep our finger on the pulse of heritage in our changing world. We will talk with leading heritage professionals in the field and discuss the biggest accomplishments and challenges of heritage today. I'm Sarah Chacon, Director of the Cultural Heritage Management Program and your host for Heritage Unbounded. Welcome to Heritage Unbounded. I'm joined today by two very special guests, Wanda Rashkow and Elizabeth Hora. Wanda serves as a statewide site stewardship program coordinator for Friends of Cedar Mesa, a conservation-focused nonprofit located in Bluff, Utah. Friends of Cedar Mesa works to ensure that public lands in San Juan County, with all their cultural natural values, are respected and protected. As part of that mission, Friends of Cedar Mesa has partnered with the Utah Bureau of Land Management to develop a heritage stewardship program. Wanda served as the federal agency archaeologist for 20 years before joining Friends of Cedar Mesa. She's worked with the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and National Park Service. Wanda believes that engaging the public in the care of our shared heritage is critical to preserving archaeological sites for the future. My other guest is Elizabeth Hora. Elizabeth is a public archaeologist for the Utah State Historic Preservation Office, or SHPO, in Salt Lake City, Utah. She holds a master's in archaeology and cultural resource management from Utah State University and specializes in Fremont archaeology, radiocarbon dating, and dendrochronology. Her most recent work focuses on eliminating damage to archaeological sites through education, stewardship, and public outreach. We are very excited to have a chance to talk with such champions of heritage stewardship. So a very special welcome to Wanda and Elizabeth.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
Now I want to begin by thinking through today's topic, which is heritage stewardship. So in order to set the stage, can you tell me a little bit about what heritage stewardship is and what it means to you? And then talk a little bit about your personal journey that led you to being one of its champions. So Wanda, why don't we start with you?
So heritage stewardship is involving the public in protecting our shared heritage. It's getting people together who really care about the resources and take a sense of pride in protecting those resources. And the resources can be prehistoric and historic archaeological sites, paleontological sites, historic trails, historic structures, any number of resources that people just care about and they want to see them protected and preserved for the next generation to enjoy. One of the things about stewards is they're so enthusiastic. They not only care about the resource, but they love to learn and they love to share what they know. So they enjoy engaging with other members of the public and sharing that information with the public. And they're just fun to be around. And that's kind of how I got my start with stewardship. Years ago, I was working for the Bureau of Land Management in California, and there's a group there, the California Archaeological Site Stewardship Program, that comes to the various BLM offices and they help host the training. So they take some of the burden off the archaeologist in terms of prep. And the people who came to that training were so enthusiastic and great to be around. And they really wanted to understand the archaeology. They got as excited about the archaeology as I was. So that's sort of where I got my start. And when you're an agency archaeologist, any excuse to go outside and hang out with the public is a good thing. So, you know, fast forward about 20 years and I saw this job for Friends of Cedar Mesa pop up in my Facebook feed. And the Cedar Mesa area is beautiful and I've vacationed here for years. And to see a job pop up that said, you will be the statewide site stewardship coordinator. All you will do is work with site stewards. It was hard to pass up. And so that's how I came to be where I am and in this position.
We'll move on to Elizabeth in just one quick second. I had a quick question kind of based on that. So people, the site stewards you're talking about are volunteers. Then they go through a specific training to become trained in a particular way? Okay.
Yes. And they are all volunteers. In some places, they may receive a stipend for mileage for gas or other expenses, but generally they're volunteers. It's all out of pocket. It's all out of their own spare time. And we train them. And one of the strong factors behind the success of the program here in Utah is that you can train in one place and work in another. So if they, say, trained in the Fillmore Field Office, which is sort of the middle of nowhere in Utah, they trained there, they could still work in the Moab Field Office, the Price Field Office. Having that consistent training helps them sort of expand and explore and discover other parts of the state.
Got it. All right. Great. Now, how about you, Elizabeth?
Yeah, really super different. So I graduated in 2005 with a degree in Egyptian archaeology, of all things, and I immediately went into CRM. Although I was an SAA member and a really enthusiastic supporter of SAA's principles of outreach and stewardship, I wasn't really much of a leader on it. I wanted to see other people doing more, I think was kind of where it came down, and griped a lot about, you know, how little archaeologists do to reach out to the public. It turns out that no one really hands you leadership roles. You kind of have to go out and create that space for yourself. It took me, I'm going to say, about 15 years, right up until like this year, to really figure that out and to be able to create the leadership role for myself, to inhabit that and to encourage other professional archaeologists to really take stewardship seriously. And so across the state, we're just starting this program. We haven't had a site stewardship program in the state for a really long time. And a lot of people in my cohort have come up over the last 10 years as professional archaeologists, agency archaeologists, and we've all been waiting for someone else to get up and do the thing for us. We've all given a lot of lip service, paid a lot of lip service to this notion. And so Wanda's done an incredible thing by being the one who stood up and said, hey, we're doing this. With the help of friends of Cedar Mesa, they got this program up and running. And so now I get to come in and be like, hey, me too. I'm also doing this. And hopefully that's going to encourage more archaeologists around the state to join in. We're going to have a culture of people wanting to get involved in heritage stewardship in a way that the state's never really seen before.
How does it balance out with the amount of volunteers that are involved? Is that something you have to actively recruit for? Is the interest already there? Are they looking for outlets to become involved and it sort of matches up? How does that work?
I guess I'll take that one since I'm currently doing the recruiting. I think there's a large untapped group within the public that would love to get involved in stewardship, but they don't even know what it is. Everybody likes to go see archaeological sites. Not everybody, but the majority of people like to go see archaeological sites. And they like to learn. We had a survey done through Friends of Cedar Mesa asking stewards, why do you get involved in site stewardship? And one of the biggest reasons was learning more about the archaeology, getting to hang out with professional archaeologists, which goes to Elizabeth's call for more archaeologists to become involved in stewardship. So there's this inherent thirst to learn more, to be able to understand the archaeology they're seeing. And we're currently, just through the BLM and the six field offices we've done training in, we have over 100 people trained in the state of Utah. And there are a couple of avocational archaeology associations, the Utah Statewide Archaeology Society and the Utah Rock Art Research Association. And they are another pool of people who already care about the archaeology, and they just need some sort of an organization, a structure to slot themselves into to become site stewards.
Feeding off of that, on the side of professional archaeologists, they also need that structure to slot themselves into. And so if we have 100 site stewards, we don't have, you know, a tenth of that for archaeologists helping out as leaders in the site stewardship program. And so using Wanda's structure, we're going to be able to encourage more participation from the professional sector just because it makes it so much easier. You know, when you can just show up to work and someone kind of tells you what to do, it's easier for everybody.
So can you walk me through a typical, what the typical role of a steward is? You know, is it just when it's the weekend and they're out visiting a site and they see stuff, or are some of those visits intentional with the idea in mind that we're looking for and we're making sure sites are maintained in a particular way? How does that work?
The program that we've designed through Friends of Cedar Mesa actually has three levels of stewardship. So it accommodates people of different abilities and interests. And one that we haven't really utilized much yet is the virtual steward. So this is someone who maybe can't get out into the backcountry, and they can stay at home and surf the internet and find all the information that's on the internet about archaeological sites and then report that. Mm-hmm. If they see something that is disturbing or alarming, they can report that to the agency. So that's one level. The next level is more the I'm going out for the weekend and I'm going to hike in an area that I know has archaeological sites. And if I see something that isn't right, I will report that back. And we call that ambassadors. And then the more traditional site stewardship format is to assign people to a specific archaeological site, either one person to one site or a group of people to multiple sites. You can kind of mix and match, but these people will have their first visit guided by a professional archaeologist. They will have the site records for that site. They will know what is supposed to be there, and they will understand the site in detail. And so when they go back, they're looking for any sort of change, small changes, large changes. Erosion is undercutting a wall, or vandals have been here and spray painted their name across the face of an art, rock art panel. So they will go, you know, with the specific intent of monitoring that site in detail.
Okay.
The frequency is up to the coordinator, the agency archaeologist, and the steward. And we have stewards that come down to southeastern Utah from other states. So they don't come frequently, but when they do, they take a really good detailed look at their archaeological sites.
Okay. Oh, interesting. So, you know, I know the state of Utah, there's a lot happening sort of in this realm right now in the state with the House Bill 163 sort of working its way. Can you talk a little bit about what that bill is and kind of what that means for formalizing stewardship in the state?
So a little bit about what House Bill 163 is and does. Representative Tim Hawks proposed the bill in the House, and it is based on the Nevada site stewardship program, one of the best site stewardships in the West, if not the country. So Wanda, you know a little bit more about Nevada.
So when I came to Friends of Cedar Mesa and started to develop the site stewardship program for the Bureau of Land Management in Utah, I looked at several different states. I had experience with the California program and the Nevada program. I'd heard Arizona was really strong. I looked at Montana, New Mexico, Texas. But the programs that seem to really have their act together are California, Arizona, and Nevada. And I stole from all those programs. And the program in Nevada is unique and I think strong because there is a law in Nevada similar to what Utah is working on now that says the state of Nevada shall have a stewardship program, and it is housed in their state historic preservation office. So they have a permanent position that coordinates the program for the entire state. And that, I think, makes that program strong, because one of the problems we run into with stewardship programs is a lack of consistency. If your agency archaeologist has a really good relationship with their site stewards and they're really into site stewardship, but then they take a job in another state, that leaves the site stewards high and dry. So the Nevada model, giving you that one central coordinator, I think is the best way to go. And that's the direction that Utah is now going with HB 163, is to create that one central point of contact for stewardship.
And housing it in the Utah Division of State History allows integration with the State Historic Preservation Office. And so the State Historic Preservation Office here in Utah is our statewide steward of all archaeological records. So whenever a project is going through on federal or state lands using federal or state money or permits, it has to get signed off by the federal government in terms of, you know, are there any archaeological sites here? Are any of them considered historic properties that could be or should be eligible for inclusion on the National Register of Historic Places? All of that data including GIS data, gets housed here at my office, the SHPO, State Historic Preservation Office. When agencies like the BLM, National Park Service, Forest Service, or State Lands go out and check on these sites using their site stewards, those forms are not standardized across the state, and the agencies don't often turn in those site records to SHPO. So although we might have had a site that was, for example, recorded in 1970s, we haven't heard anything about that site since then. Although site stewards have been out on the ground collecting great information, and information that the agency in some cases would like to use to buttress their case for or against these things being included on the National Register of Historic Places. So it's great for us to have our new potential site stewardship program housed within state history, because it does allow us to shunt those records over to the State Historic Preservation Office. That way, you know, say someone wants to build a road through Grand County, we can quickly look at those records and say, all right, a professional archaeologist hasn't been out there since 1970. But last year we had three site stewards go out and they said it's in great shape. So now we can sort of manage our time as land managing agencies and say, all right, I'm just going to jet out there real quick. I'm not expecting any problems. Smooth sailing. So it's really great for the resource, and it's really great for agencies to follow this Nevada model and keep it statewide.
It sounds like you've taken, Wanda, when you looked at what different places do and sort of your experiences with those different places, best practices from a lot of different approaches. What's different about the Utah model than some of those other states that do things well?
I think one of the differences is that we have those three levels, and we're really promoting stewardship for everybody. And the virtual steward idea actually came from a training class that I attended with the Nevada Site Stewardship Program. One of the volunteers, older, not very able to hike long distances, was like, can't we just do this on the internet? And I was like, you know, that is an awesome idea. Let's borrow that idea. So I think that having that one person at the top coordinating everybody, training everybody at once, one of the burdens of site stewardship for an agency archaeologist, and you know, I hate to say that site stewardship is a burden, but there are not enough agency archaeologists. When I worked in California for the Bureau of Land Management, it was me and over 2 million acres of land. When I worked for the Park Service, it was me and a park that was over 3 million acres of land. There's not enough of us. So you bring us site stewards, that's great. But then we have to take the time to go out with them to the sites and get them set up. Once they're set up, they repay our efforts multiple, you know, a thousandfold. But it's that initial getting them set up that is so difficult. So it's great to have someone at the state office level that is going to put on the trainings. It's going to train regional coordinators, which is another factor that's really important, is you have to have other people sort of between the agency archaeologist, between the statewide coordinator, and the actual steward. And those regional coordinators then can be the ones who take people out onto the sites. So you kind of have to have this whole relationship, this whole family of people working together to get the stewards trained and mentored and out on their sites. So that's a strength of the Nevada model, is you have a central person, you have regional coordinators who, and the central person and the regional coordinators interface with the agency archaeologists, and they all come together to get that steward trained and ready to go.
You mentioned digital a little bit, and I noticed on the Frances Eder Mesa website, there's something called Arc Monitor. Can you tell me a little bit about what Arc Monitor is and how that fits into that bigger stewardship picture?
Arc Monitor is a mobile app for stewards to take to the field to document their site observations. In the past, it was all paperwork, and then they would send pieces of paper into the agency archaeologist who would, you know, stack them on their desk somewhere nicely. And at the end of the year, every agency archaeologist is supposed to report how many sites have been monitored, how many hours, volunteer hours. And you've got this stack of paper sitting on your desk that you then have to sort through. So from the agency perspective, ArcMonitor is a really good app in that it spits out all that data for them. It spits out how many hours, how many site visits, how many volunteers are involved. It gives them all that data. But more importantly, it also provides a way for the site stewards to report immediately to the agency if they see something wrong. So a steward goes out to their site with their tablet or their phone, and they have certain spots that they're supposed to go to that we call baseline photos. So they go to those spots, they look at the baseline photos from the past, they look at the site, and they say, meh, nothing's changed. They go to the next photo point, they look at the baseline photo, they look at how it is now, and they're like, oh no, someone has been here with a can of spray paint. So they take their photos, they make the comments on what happened, and then when they get back to where they have internet service, they hit the submit button, and it fires an email off to the agency archaeologist. It can be set up to send a notification to the law enforcement rangers. So it's an instant feedback to the agency about what the stewards are seeing out in the field. And it also captures all their reports, all the photos they take, all the comments they make. So all of that is there now, and it doesn't get stacked on the agency archaeologist's desk. It exists. It's easy to look at. And it provides good statistics. And the stewards, once we get them through the basics of registration, because that seems to be the hardest part of the whole thing, they really have fun with it. They seem to really enjoy being able to go out and just snap their pictures and send in their comments. So,
is the idea that that data would be aggregated at the State Historic Preservation Office and then centralized through this sort of centralized location then?
Yes, as it is now, it goes to the agency archaeologists, and the agency archaeologists have reporting duties. They're supposed to report all this information up to the State Historic Preservation Office. But as Elizabeth has alluded to, that doesn't happen all the time. So with the ArcMonitor, the State Historic Preservation Office will be able to call up the database and look and see what's going on whenever they need to.
That's great. It's real time. And you can probably long-term start seeing patterns too, I would think, in terms of where you see activity happening and changes happening and things like that. And like you mentioned before, Elizabeth, it's a good way to manage your resources then as well, right? In terms of what appears to need more protection, what seems to be doing just fine.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I don't know if maybe this is a good time to pivot to the combat vandalism campaign, but we're actually starting to look at those data, look at those trends.
And so tell me a little bit about what the combat vandalism campaign is. It's a great segue.
Yeah. So we right now have really spotty data, and it might actually be great, but who knows, because no one's ever looked at it. We've been collecting all this information about vandalism, about other effects, negative effects to archaeological sites, and we sort of have left those data to lie fallow in our statewide databases. And so right now, the Utah Professional Archaeology Council, UPAC, is forming a subcommittee to resurrect these data and to take a good hard look at them and see, do we see any trends in the data? Do archaeological sites tend to be harder hit when they are near towns, when they are more or less heavily trafficked? You know, maybe having a site that always has someone on it is actually protective. So we actually just don't know. We have a lot of data from the natural resources community, but cultural resources, particularly in the West, we don't have a lot of great data. So as a part of Utah Public Archaeology Network's campaign to combat vandalism, UPAC, there's a lot of acronyms. There's UPAN and UPAC. And so UPAC has stood up and said, we're going to help out by crunching some numbers. We're professional archaeologists. We have access to the SHPO database. So we're going to pull down some of these numbers and take a look and see if we can actually predict where archaeological vandalism may occur next so we can head it off the path, so that we can mobilize these stewards, so that we can mobilize ambassadors like Like Wanda was mentioning, we have that Visit with Respect Ambassador program that Friends of Cedar Mesa is using down in the Bears Ears region. So maybe we want to create that into another kind of statewide initiative to just let the public know that these sites are known, that they're loved, and that they're monitored. Because when we can demonstrate that people value archaeology and that people are loving archaeology, there's less damage to them.
And following up on that, one of the aspects of the stewardship program that we developed through Friends of Cedar Mesa is the Visit with Respect. We have a program where we train people just to be ambassadors. They don't necessarily report archaeological damage, but they're out on the trails and they talk to people and they teach people how to visit sites with respect. You know, tie your dog up outside the site. Don't let your children climb on ruin walls and things like that. So we took that and incorporated it into the site stewardship program. So we spend about an hour of our training talking about Visit with Respect principles, but also teaching our stewards, how do you talk to the public? How not to be confrontational, how to gently share information with them. And the stewards, that's one of the things in the surveys, they love to share with the public. They want to talk to the public. They want to educate the public. And so we're trying to give them tools to do that in a way that keeps them safe and serves the resource.
It's a great program. I'm just going to hop in and say, I'm a Visit with Respect ambassador. I took the training. And my dog is a bark ranger, although he doesn't
take anything. I love it, a bark ranger.
A bark ranger. Yes. We train the dogs how to treat the archaeological sites with respect. And they get a little cute little tag for their collar.
Yeah.
And, you know, for people that are listening, if you go to the Friends of Cedar Mesa website, there's a whole set of videos on Visit with Respect, how to walk up to a site and not damage it, and a whole video on rock cairns, because people like to put rock cairns everywhere. And sometimes they are disassembling archaeological sites to build the cairns. And then there's the whole impact to the landscape of having rock cairns everywhere. So there's a lot of good resources on our website to help you learn to visit with respect.
And one of the nice things that I keep hearing both of you say is the role of learning and the role of interpretation. I think when, you know, I first hear heritage stewardship, immediately comes to mind is conservation and preservation. But it's so important to have that interpretation piece as part of that too. So when you develop your trainings and include that kind of piece of communicating with different constituencies, where do you pull those resources from? Is that something that you developed in-house? Is that something that you've pulled from other places?
The way we schedule a training is we have sort of segments that follow the manual, safety, how to visit a site your first time, you know, what types of things to look for, what are the laws that govern archaeological sites. But we also incorporate a segment that's generated by the agency archaeologist, where they talk about what are the resources in this area? What are you likely to find out there when you're walking around? We also invite Native Americans to come and speak about what's important to them. The prehistoric sites are their ancestors. And so stewards love to hear from the Native Americans, and I think it gives them more of a sense of a tie to that past and more respect for that past. We will also incorporate paleontologists because fossils are heritage resources too. So we try to bring in as many different people as possible. One of the programs here in Utah that has been operating for, I think, decades now and is doing really well is the stewardship program out of the Monticello field office for the Bureau of Land Management. And why they're different is that they have managed to find funding to have a local museum, the Edge of the Cedars, be the regional coordinator. And they, instead of just doing a 1 year, we train everybody and then we just kind of have them do their stewardship thing, Monticello and Edge of Cedars, they do a training every year, and every year it's different. So the first year you're going to get the manual and how to be a steward, but the next year you might get more on safety. This year I'm going to teach them how to draw sketch maps of their sites so that they can pencil in where their photo points are. And Native Americans and videos that have been made, and they will get a tour of the back room of the museum or have artifacts brought out that they can look at. That program has 50 stewards, 50 or more stewards, and some of them have been stewards for over 10 years. And it's because they're constantly getting that enrichment, that engagement back.
Great to hear that that's such an important piece of the Heritage Stewardship Program. We talked a little bit about some of the challenges, the vandalism, just remoteness of locations, all those kinds of bits and pieces. What do you guys see as the primary challenge or barrier to a successful heritage stewardship program in Utah specifically? What are you seeing as some of the bigger barriers?
One of the biggest barriers from my point of view is professional retention. We have so many stewards, and like Wanda said, some of them have been there for 10 years. We have members of USAS who have been working with USAS since, in some cases, the 1980s. So our stewards aren't necessarily going anywhere. The problem is our professionals don't often stick around. Here in Utah, when we have BLM archaeologists come in, sometimes they're only here for 2 years because it's just the structure of that system where they have to move on in order to move up in their organization. There's not a lot of in situ development, in situ promotion possibilities. So here at the state office, we're a lot more stable. I've been in my position going on 4 years now, and I have no intention of leaving. And so it's going to be my job and the job of our site stewardship coordinator, should it come through with House Bill 163, to really help that professional retention, to help people say, like, you need to invest here in Utah. You're not just here for a second. There are real people here. The resource here is important. And we need your help to come out and give site tours to foster site stewardship in your area. So across, BLM, Forest Service, Park Service, State Lands, professional retention is going to be our biggest issue. Add to that, the CRM community. So the cultural resource management community, or CRM community, often don't have time in their lives, or they feel they don't have time in their lives to engage with the site stewardship program. And so it's up to us to tell them, it's really just a couple of weekends a year, a few weekends here and there, a few weekdays here and there, and you can help out with the site stewardship program. And it's also going to be our responsibility to go to their managers, their supervisors, the people who run these companies, and say, hey, you know what's going to be really great is if you give people an 8-hour volunteer time period every year that they can use to go out and help out site stewardship programs. So we need to just really create a culture of stewardship across professional archaeology community that we don't really have yet. So that's actually going to be a huge challenge. Anytime you're talking about culture change, it's nothing small, but we're really excited to get started on it, especially if House Bill 163 passes. We'll have one person whose sole job is to make sure that this gets pulled off without a hitch.
And I'd like to echo what Elizabeth said. It's about consistency and relationships. In my experience, you form a relationship with your stewards. And if you go away, if you leave for another BLM office, it's that relationship more than anything that keeps stewardship going. And so having people that are there consistently, that provide consistent support for the program and invest in those relationships with their stewards, is what's going to keep the program healthy and strong. The other thing, one of the other challenges we have is demographics of our stewards. Most of the stewards are retired or semi-retired, which implies older, and they have the time, they have the expendable income to commit to going to their site on a regular basis, to spending the money to put gas in their tank. We need to find a way to diversify. We need younger people involved, because as our demographics, as those people age out, who's going to follow behind them? We need to reach out to the schools and get people involved, younger and more diversity in terms of ethnic backgrounds. It makes sense to have Native Americans stewarding Native American sites. We just had the anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad. The Chinese immigrants played a huge part in that. So we should have them helping to steward the work camps that their ancestors may have lived in. So we need to broaden our base and reach out to more groups of people to keep stewardship going. And the ambassador program kind of helps with that, because you can take a scout troop and have an area that they just go to repeatedly. They don't have to record the archaeology in detail, but it becomes their site to take care of. And so as they get older, they will take that love of archaeology forward with them. And when they're settled and living in one place, perhaps they'll become stewards in that place.
That's a lot of challenges, but but I think, you know, it's heartening to hear how much this has been thought through. There are some real considerations and some intentionality behind what's happening right now in Utah and the efforts that you both are involved in. And so from an outsider looking in, I'm pretty confident that you guys are going to be moving it in a good direction. So kind of with that, if you aren't in Utah, and you aren't out west for that matter, in California, Nevada, Arizona, but you're interested in heritage site stewardship, is there a way to get involved? How might you go about looking locally where you are? Let's say you're from the Northeast or the Southeast or the Midwest, for example. What kinds of resources should you be looking out for, and where might you look for similar kinds of programs in your area?
Great question. I think it varies state by state. So I would start looking at either your state archaeologist's website or your state historic preservation office's website. And if there's nothing there, move on to BLM, Forest Service, and National Parks.
Chris and Beth Payden, who established the California Stewardship Program, are starting a nationwide Partners for Archaeological Site Stewardship. So they're trying to look at everything, you know, nationwide. But one of the things that hinders the Northeast is that most of the public land is in the West. And so a lot of the stewardship programs are partnerships between volunteers and public land managers. So the national parks are a place to look, because they're everywhere. And if you can't be a steward, you can be a docent or a volunteer in some other way with the national parks. In the West, it's best to reach out to your land managing agencies, the Forest Service, the BLM. Those are probably the two largest, the Park Service. And we are going to have a regional stewardship meeting in Las Vegas on October 14th. There's a conference going on. It's called the Great Basin Anthropological Conference, or GBAC. And it starts on Wednesday and runs through the weekend. And if you like archaeology, GBAC is great. There's archaeology, anthropology all weekend long, and there'll be field trips on Sunday. So we've slotted ourselves in on the Wednesday before GBAC to have a regional stewardship conference. We're going to spend part of our time talking about best practices from other states. And then the afternoon is going to be educational things for site stewards. And so far, we've got California, Nevada, Arizona,
Utah,
Florida is coming. We may have somebody from a park in Canada. Alaska is sending representatives. So we're going to have a lot of coordinators from the Western states and Florida. It'd be a great place to learn about how stewardship works and to get lots of resources to go home and slot yourself into a stewardship program. For Utah, people can reach out to me, and the email address I use for stewardship is ArcMonitor, so ARCH Monitor, MONITOR, at CedarMesaFriends.org. And we also have the Utah Heritage Stewardship Program Facebook page. That is a mouthful. So those are places, if you're in Utah, that's a good place to start.
And it sounds like, too, even if we aren't, we can get involved in the digital aspect of sort of that phase one heritage stewardship, right? And so we could probably jump in right now from wherever we are in the Northeast looking at those internet sites. So I'll definitely include on our page a link to Friends of Cedar Mesa and to reach out to you, Wanda.
And also send them to UPAN.
Yeah, that's right.
At the Division of State History, the Utah Public Archaeology Network, Elizabeth is doing a lot to reach out to the public and get the public engaged with archaeology.
And it sounds like you've got a lot of work ahead of you with this, and hopefully, fingers crossed, with the HB 163.
Yeah, no, we've got a lot more than just HB 163 going on. So I'm public archaeologist for the state of Utah. We have a website history, this is long, history.utah.gov/antiquities/UPAN. But we also have a monthly newsletter that people can sign up if they want to keep track of what's going on with HB 163. Eventually we'll have site stewardship on there, assuming that all goes swimmingly. And you can sign up for that at bit.ly/combatvandalism. And that's kind of a nod to our 2020 campaign to combat archaeological vandalism. So again, bit.ly/combatvandalism.
And I'll include a link to that as well. And folks can learn a little bit more about that combat vandalism. So I'll be keeping an eye to see sort of some of the outcomes of that data. It's always interesting to me once that starts aggregating the kinds of patterns that can come sort of on the back end of that.
We anticipate that once we have results from that we're going to be distributing them far and wide, because it's a huge knowledge gap in archaeology. We don't really think about what modern people are doing. We always have our eyes looked to the past, and we're not really looking at what's going on around us. So we're really excited to get that going, and we will definitely be distributing the results.
Well, thank you. Thank you both so very much. Any last words you'd like to leave us with? I mean, we've got some great resources available for folks. I'll make sure we have links to those on our program website where we post the podcast. And we'll keep our eye out for the bill, the conference coming up in October, all those bits and pieces. Anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with? Any parting words?
I would encourage people to get involved. And you asked, how can they find out about stewardship? Just Google archaeology and your state and see what pops up. There are organizations in every state for people who are enthusiastic and want to learn more about archaeology. So learn more, become engaged, spread the word to your friends and family.
Yep. And I would say, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably in a position to be more of a leader than you think you are. So please feel empowered to go out and, you know, preach the good word of archaeological stewardship and heritage education and taking care of our resources. Because everyone listening to this podcast knows that we really only get one shot at it, that these are non-renewable resources, as we really like to say. But just saying that isn't enough. You need to go out and you need to inspire other people to help take care of these sites.
Well, thank you so much, both of you. This has been a really great conversation. And I know I, for one, am inspired.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Spread the word and invite your friends. And join us again next time for another episode of Heritage Unbounded, brought to you by the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program and the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs, Johns Hopkins University. Podcast music features the piano instrumental Gonzaga Gaucho by Mark Staub.